Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. My name, not surprisingly, is Michael Cutler. I wish all of you a very happy Friday, and hope that you find a wonderful way to celebrate the waning days of summer. After all, this weekend will be the final weekend of August. So, however you and your family and friends generally do so, have at it. Celebrate the weekend, celebrate summer, and fall is on its way, and with it, of course, Election Day. Lots to think about, lots to talk about. I think you all know that I am a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. I've been retired for a number of years, but my career spanned some 30 years. Rather than get into my career and what I've done in the past, I would suggest that you go to my website, michaelcutler.net, michaelcutler.net, or please visit another wonderful website, and that is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org, and that, of course, is the website for Californians for Population Stabilization, an organization that I am pleased to have been associated with for a number of years. I am currently a senior fellow with CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. They are located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara. I know that my friends out there will find a wonderful way to celebrate this weekend. Their weather is almost always fabulous. But for the rest of you, I hope the weather works out for you as well. And finally, please go to talkborder.com. In fact, I most recently posted a very good interview because of my guest, not because of me. And his name is Martin Seif, a renowned journalist, three times nominated for the Pulitzer Prize, a man who has found his way around the world. He's been clear across this globe, covering all sorts of revolutions and wars, the demise of the old Soviet Union, although I worry about whether it's really down for the count the way Mr. Putin does business. You have to wonder about that. And in fact, in a couple of minutes, Martin will be joining me. It was so much fun having him on my radio program in the past. It was great doing that Skype interview with him for TalkBorder.com, and you can go to that website. It's one word, TalkBorder.com. And if you go to the upper left photograph, you could see Martin, and click on that. You'll read a little bit about him, including his bio, and then we have the video interview, which I was thrilled to do because he's an engaging character, very well-traveled, very well-educated, but also very entertaining. So I'm looking forward to him joining us shortly. But, you know, in the meanwhile, what I do want to focus on for the moment is an interesting story. At present, there are 10 special agents of the INS led by the president of the union that represents the ICE agents, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, in suing the administration over what the administration calls prosecutorial discretion, this idea that they will allow illegal aliens for 2 years to work in the United States. It's a violation of law in their judgment and in my judgment. You know, we hear so much from the conservative side about the evils of unions. You know, anytime we put too much power in one location, we have a problem. But unions are not necessarily inherently evil. I am a great believer in balance, that when people go to work, that they give their employer a full day's work, but that in return, they have appropriate working conditions and an opportunity to support themselves and their families. In law enforcement, it's particularly important, it's vital, that law enforcement officers get protection, because when you're out there, you're not only concerned about getting shot, stabbed, or punched by the bad guys, but you also worry about lawsuits, you worry about your agency, whether it's a local police department or a federal law enforcement agency, leaving you out there dangling by yourself. It's kind of like Mission Impossible, you know? If you get caught, they will disavow any knowledge. Well, increasingly, that seems to be the tactic of government. Certainly at ICE, we've seen agents get into trouble for trying to do their job. So I think this lawsuit is very important. It's important to try to protect the agents who understand that as citizens, as well as federal employees, they know just how important our immigration laws are. And to sum it up in six words, we have immigration laws to protect American lives and protect American jobs. Both goals are very important, especially given the current perilous era that we live in. We are threatened by terrorism. We are threatened by transnational gangs. We are threatened by the Mexican cartels, by drug use and the crimes that emanate from that. And we are also threatened as a nation by a faltering economy. Certainly, this economy is showing no evidence of turning around, not anytime soon. CBS at 60 Minutes has done a number of stories about poverty in America. They've made the same statement that ABC News made last year, that about a quarter of all American children are now living below the poverty line. It's astonishing to me that at a time when Americans can't find work, that the administration thinks it's appropriate to give millions of illegal aliens employment authorization. Now, what you should understand is that once you provide an alien with that document that says you are authorized to work in the United States, that alien has every bit as much right to take a job as does a United States citizen or a lawful immigrant. Greece, in fact, and we hear so much about Portugal, Italy, Spain, and Greece, you know, the pigs country, so-called, P-I-G-S, has decided to secure its borders against illegal aliens because they want to get their citizens to work. You don't bring more people to the table when there's not enough food to go around in the first place. Yet this administration is doing precisely that, and they are creating a national security disaster in the process. Because let's face it, we all know that there is no way that Citizenship and Immigration Services, that beleaguered arm of DHS, the DHS, of course, Department of Homeland Security, I've come to refer to it as the Department of Homeland Surrender, however, DHS would have to process perhaps 8 or 9 million applications. Normally they process 6 to 7 million. If you add a couple of million to the desks of those employees, you know that they're going to have a severe problem. And that's exactly where they are today. They are desperately in need of more personnel, not more work. So the only way that they will be able to adjudicate the applications of these employees would be simply to approve the applications. Now, of course, they're not going to tell those people, you've got to approve all these applications, because they know that the noise that the employees would make would be deafening. So what do? They turn around and tell their employees, and I'm sure that they will do this. I did adjudications work for a year as an immigration employee. All they have to do is say to them, listen, we want you to make sure that you do everything you can in order to weed out the fraud. Just make certain that you process a minimum of 30 or 40 applications per day, and I guarantee you that's what's going to happen, is that you're going to get all of these folks getting their applications approved, because there will be no way for Citizenship and Immigration Services to not approve the applications if they're going to meet those quotas that will be established for them. So that really is wherein lies this huge problem that we now have, the idea that there will be no integrity to the system. And if you provide illegal aliens who cannot prove who they are with the benefit that they apply for, not knowing for certain that they even meet the requirements, that they were here for the required period of time, that they entered prior to age 16, I believe is the cutoff, that they're no older than their 31st birthday, that they've done all these other things, and even to the point of who they really are, there's a problem. And we know that there will be no interviews, and we know that fraud has already been identified as a huge problem where immigration is concerned and where the terrorist attacks of 9/11 are concerned. We know that on 9/11, the terrorists who did such damage to us entered our country illegally or legally, but when I say illegally, they committed visa fraud. They lied on their applications. They lied when they spoke to the inspectors at the airports. And then, of course, we know what happened afterwards. We know that many of them, in fact, applied for and received immigration benefits that enabled them to embed themselves in our country. Again, this is the problem that we're confronting today, that these folks would wind up coming to the United States, claiming to have been here the required period of time, lying about their true identities, and then guess what? They would wind up getting official identity documents that would enable them to have access to airplanes, access to jobs, access to critical infrastructure or places that have national security implications. And the union representatives and the employees of ICE looking at this fiasco have decided to step up to the plate and initiate a lawsuit. So that's where we stand with that. Now, what's very encouraging is that Senator David Vitter, who is the Republican senator from Louisiana, along with Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican from Alabama, Senate Judiciary Committee ranking member Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, have all issued statements in support of the lawsuit because they understand the dangers inherent in what it is that this administration seems to be determined to do. So that being said, we as Americans need to get our voices heard. We need to make certain to reach out to our elected representatives and make certain that they understand how important it is for them to stand with the agents and not with the administration. This isn't a conservative issue. The three members of the U.S. Senate that I just noted, of course, are all Republicans, but this is not a Republican issue. I'm registered as a Democrat. This is an American issue. Because I don't know of any American, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, who doesn't think it's essential that we get Americans back to work, that we don't secure our borders to prevent the entry of criminals, that we don't allow terrorists to enter the United States. So when you look at it from that perspective, how on earth can you possibly talk about the need to protect America and Americans and get Americans back to work and not talk about the need to enforce the immigration laws? What the administration is planning to do right now would be, I believe, to undermine American workers, make a mockery of the laws that the lawful immigrants, and we admit more than 1.1 million every year, and to make a mockery of the laws that they followed in waiting their turn and in coming to America looking to get their thin slice of the American dream. And then, of course, we wind up with all the national security issues as well. In fact, the other thing that you should consider is that there was a very interesting news report at CBS, and this was Scott Paley reported this August 23rd, just yesterday. And here's the headline, CBS News: Mexican drug cartels fight turf battles in Chicago. Now, think about that one. And let me start out by reading a little bit of this. Gun violence is out of control in Chicago. Just last night, there were 8 shootings, 2 of them deadly. That pushes the total so far in 2012 to 351 shooting deaths, up 30% from last year. Drug gangs are a big reason. In the afternoon drive on Chicago's southwest side, Jack Riley sees signs of what he calls the toxic drug war laying waste to the city. You should know that Jack Riley is the DEA's special agent in charge of the Chicago office. So he makes that statement and then goes on to say that turf battles over drugs are turning parts of Chicago into a Mexican border town. Let me repeat this. DEA special agent in charge of the Chicago Office of the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, an agency I had the privilege of working with for approximately half of my career as an INS agent. I was assigned to DEA Intelligence. I was assigned to the Drug Task Force for 10 years. I was with DEA Intelligence for 4 years before that. They certainly have their finger on the pulse. So the agent in charge of the Chicago office of DEA makes this statement. The turf battles over drugs are turning parts of Chicago into a Mexican border town. It takes my breath away to hear that kind of an unbelievable statement. And let me continue to read the rest of this. And he says, one of the hardest jobs I've had in the past couple of years is to convince our law enforcement partners that we need an enforcement mentality as if we are on the border, Riley said. Miles away, Riley says, Mexican cartels have a significant influence in Chicago's gang violence problem. Let's take the gloves off on that, he said. We know that the majority of drugs here in Chicago cartels are responsible for. We know that the majority of the murders are gang-related, so it is very clear to see the connection and the role. As it stands now, at least three major Mexican cartels are battling over control of billions of dollars of marijuana, cocaine, and increasingly heroin in the city. That includes the ultra-violent Zetas and the powerful Sinaloa cartel run by their shadowy leader, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. The most dangerous criminal across all the crime world is Chapo Guzman, and this is one of his hubs, Riley said. It is not surprising why Guzman operates in Chicago, the city's location, and easy access to a wide variety of transportation. You've got to look at Chicago from a perspective of logistics, of business logistics. It's an ideal spot to set up shop. To fight back, Riley has taken lessons he learned 5 years ago as an agent in charge of DEA's El Paso office. He's formed a 25-agency strike force featuring state and federal prosecutors, FBI, ATF, and local police that began operations in January. It's focused shutting down the choke points where gang leadership meets cartel lieutenants. But now here's something that I find remarkable as I read this. They talk about the FBI and ATF and local police, but where's immigration? Where's immigration? You see, so when you look at the kind of lunacy that we're looking at here, and you realize that it's vital that we do what we need to do to secure or enforce the immigration laws from within Chicago, we're in a bad place. Because if our government refuses to enforce immigration laws, we're not going to win the battle. I was, as an immigration agent, very successful, and so were my colleagues from the INS. This isn't about Mike Cutler. It's about the immigration laws, about prosecuting criminal aliens who come here, who reenter the United States illegally. You can take them off the street. It doesn't matter if you don't find them with drugs. They're being present on street corners after they were deported because they had been convicted of serious crimes is enough, absolutely enough, to get these people put away. So why on earth would you not want to go after them in that fashion? Why on earth would you not want to go after them from every possible perspective? That's what really needs to be understood, that we have absolutely got to look at the immigration laws as a vital tool in order to enforce the laws against cartel members. Marty, are you on with us? Yeah, come on board. Anyway, so the point that I make is that here we are attempting to look at the situation realistically and saying, what on earth do we do? What on earth are we supposed to do if our leaders are not willing to do the right thing, if they're not willing to understand the immigration laws in a way that makes sense, in a way where we use the immigration laws to go after the criminal aliens who are deported and come back illegally, to go after the visa fraud, to charge the criminal aliens with possession of firearms, which carries a 10-year penalty. There are so many tools that the immigration laws can be instrumental in, and yet, where are they? Nowhere to be found in that news article. Nobody mentioning the need to enforce immigration laws so that we can use them as an effective weapon against the cartels. That's what's so astonishing. That's what I don't understand. Why we talk about this whole idea that Chicago is as dangerous as a Mexican border town, but the immigration laws don't figure into any of the equations. That's something that I find inconceivable. I'm going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in about a minute or so. Bear with me. I'm hopeful that we will get Martin Seif to join us momentarily. We seem to be having a technical problem with the ability for him to call in. But while we're waiting for Marty, here he is. Here's Marty now.
Sure.
Marty, there you are. Hello?
Sure.
Hi, Marty Seif. How are you? Happy Friday.
Fine, thanks, Mike. Good to be on.
Well, glad to have you. For those of my listeners who aren't familiar with you, why don't you give them just a thumbnail sketch of who you are and the mischief that you've been up to? How's that?
Okay. I'm a veteran journalist originally from Northern Ireland, been in this country for about 30 years. I'm the former chief foreign correspondent of the Washington Times and former managing editor of United Press International. And currently, among other things, I'm the chief analyst for the Globalist online magazine, www.theglobalist.com, and most recently the author of That Still Should Be Us, a book on how to revive U.S. industrial and the U.S. economy and through U.S. energy and the revival of industry.
It's remarkable. You would think everybody should be on the same page, and they should understand that if we're going to get Americans back to work, that we should try our best to make certain the people getting the jobs are American citizens. And, you know, you mentioned you were born in Ireland, but I also know you're a naturalized citizen.
Oh, very much so. My wife's American, and my kids are all U.S. born and bred as well.
So let me ask you a question. As an immigrant, okay, because although now you're properly identified as a citizen, I know you're a dual national, but you are an American citizen. How
yes,
does it make you feel when you listen to the President of the United States basically tell illegal aliens that they don't have to worry about going through the normal process, that they can, as illegal aliens, get employment authorization? We could be looking at a couple of million people that we're talking about. We're not talking about a handful.
I didn't find it so easy. I came through the legal processes. I had to work hard for years. I had to have lawyers guzzle many thousands of dollars of my money to get the procedure worked through, and I was coming through legally. I was playing the game.
Well, let me ask you a question. How long ago did you naturalize?
Let me see. Well over... I was green card for the first few years I was here. I've been a full citizen now for about 20 years.
Okay, now you probably had to provide two witnesses when you came in.
Yeah, sure.
Do you know that they've eliminated the requirement for the witnesses?
No, but I'm not surprised. But, I mean, really, I love this country. I came here because I love this country. But
right.
It seems to me being loving this country has become a mug's game, and it's meaningless. You have two serious presidential candidates, both of whom are completely committed to outsourcing, even if the president says Romney's entire life proves this and career. The president says he isn't, but Jeffrey Immelt of General Electric is his chief advisor in jobs creation. That's like putting Al Capone in charge of prohibition. or making a Mexican drug lord in charge of border security. Immelt is personally responsible for at least 60,000 GE jobs going over to Asia every year. But you cannot fight this. America needs to have economic borders as well as its physical borders, and it needs to defend both, and it's defending neither. And anyone like you, or for that matter like me on the economic side, who argues that America needs to defend itself, we're the marginalized ones. We never get invited to Aspen. We never get on the red page of the New York Times, and we're never going to.
Let me tell you something that's interesting. Before you came on, when we had to get the connection all squared away, I was just reading an article that is based on a CBS Evening News report that Scott Pelley did just last night. Here's the headline, Mexican drug cartels fight turf battles in Chicago. And it turns out that the head of the Chicago office of DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, is a guy by the name of Jack Riley. Riley, interestingly, before he went to Chicago, was the special agent in charge of the DEA office in El Paso, which is the most violent, which is across the river from the most violent city in Mexico, Ciudad Juarez. I've been to El Paso. That's where bullets came across the border and struck City Hall in El Paso. I jokingly wrote a commentary when that happened a couple of years ago saying that the administration would probably say that the Mexicans were simply returning bullets that they had borrowed from us at the time, because it's all about spin and it's all about the way they portray things. But what he had said really stuck in my craw, because he said, and here's the quote, that daily turf battles over drugs and distribution, he said, are turning parts of the Midwest city into a Mexican border town. And then he goes on and says that one of the hardest jobs I've had in the past couple of years is to convince law enforcement partners that we need enforcement mentality as if we were on the border. And he said, miles away, Mexican cartels have a significant influence on Chicago's gang violence problem. And he said, let's take the gloves off. And he talks about putting all of these task forces together, you know, with the FBI and ATF and local police. And you know what's astonishing? Now, maybe it was a misstatement on his part, but there wasn't a word in the news report about the need to get immigration involved in the battle. We're talking about aliens from Mexico peddling drugs and shooting up the city. The level of violence, the way the story starts out, is saying that gun violence is out of control in Chicago. Just last night, there were 8 shootings, 2 of them deadly, and that pushes the total so far in 2012 to 351 shooting deaths, up 30% from last year. Drug gangs are a big reason. Well, my experience as an immigration agent, and I work with the DEA in New York, is that the people that are mostly responsible for the violence are the aliens, illegal aliens, who come here to act as the enforcers, who peddle this dope, this poison, to the street-level distributors. But at the upper echelon, one notch up sometimes, you have all these illegal aliens who've come here doing their thing. And their thing is to poison our children, 70% of crime directly, indirectly believed to be drug-related. You've got all this violence, and they're talking about putting all these agencies together, but God forbid you should talk about enforcing immigration laws that are a wonderful tool. You know, one of my responsibilities when I was at DEA and when I was working with the FBI and working with local police was to create informants, to provide opportunities to those illegal aliens who would step forward and provide evidence or work undercover for us with a green card, ultimately. There's a section of law that provides for visas for those folks. And while we hear about community policing, you can't find a better example of community policing than getting cooperators and informants. And on the other hand, you can put people away for up to 20 years for unlawful reentry. So you don't have to worry if the guy has a gun on him or drugs. If you arrest somebody and he's an illegal alien who was deported and has conviction record, he's looking at a minimum of 5 years in prison and a max of 20, and then you can load on other charges, illegal alien with a firearm, possession of drugs, conspiracy, and so forth. Yet not a word about, God forbid, enforcing the immigration laws. How insane is that?
I think if you regard the country as being in a terminal state of dissolution, it's perfectly sane. But if you actually take patriotism and national self-defense and survival seriously, then of course it's insane.
I mean, I don't get it. I have to tell you. We keep on hearing this nonsense that, you know, Mayor Bloomberg said, well, the illegals come here purely to work. They don't want welfare. They just want hard jobs. And they don't need to run the border if they want to come here. Let them come in through an airport with a visa and overstay. Well, in fact, we have millions of illegal aliens who've done just that, and we don't look for them. In fact, today with the current administration, we'd probably be looking to give them employment authorization. You know, it's amazing that enforcement of immigration laws are so disconnected from national security in the minds of the public because of the politicians and the media, so disconnected from community safety, so disconnected from making certain that Americans get jobs so they can support themselves and their families. My dad was a construction worker, and we hear this mythology, well, the illegals do the work Americans won't do. And last night, my son and I sat down to watch the film October Sky. It was based on a book by Homer Hickam, and Hickam was a NASA engineer, grew up in a coal mining town in the 50s. He's a little bit older than I am. I had the privilege of a 30-minute phone conversation with him a couple of years ago. And when he delivered the eulogy at the Sago mine disaster, he said something that choked me up. It made me think of my father and all those hardworking blue-collar Americans. He said, there's no water holier than the sweat off a man's brow. And now we actually elect politicians who insult blue-collar Americans and basically saying that Americans are either too lazy to do the tough jobs or too stupid to do the high-tech jobs, because all we hear from these globalists, which is what they are, is the need to take down borders and bring in as many foreign workers as possible, the illegals at the bottom rung, the high-tech workers with the H-1B and other visas at the upper end of the spectrum. Meanwhile, what is America's future going to look like, Martin?
America's future right now, unless it changes, is going to be, make Mexico look positively golden in comparison. And there's a reason for that. With all the problems in Mexico, all the drug problems in the northern provinces, the current and previous Mexican governments have taken much more seriously preserving and developing their industrial sector than we have with ours. And current projections of growth, Mexico in 2030 will have a standard of will be the 8th or 10th largest industrial economy in the world. They could easily, by 2030, have outstripped us.
Wow. Well, I think they're number 14 now. Is that about right, number 14?
Yes, that's exactly correct. Everything that you've just said is for all your listeners and your audience, look up my book, Amazon.com. My name is Martin Seif, S-I-E-F for Frank, F for Frank. And the book is called That Still Should Be Us. It's a crummy title for which you can thank the geniuses of Wiley Publishing in Hoboken. I'm never going to work with them again.
But you may not like the title, but I do like the author, and I certainly agree with the message. How does that work for you, Martin?
Well, that's a good start. Thank you, Mike. As you well know, we're good friends, and I appreciate that. But as I say to your audience, that still should be us, because everything Mike says is true. The free trade open borders fallacy has destroyed the middle class in America, is destroying it, has totally decimated the working class in America, has done the American people worse damage than Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, the Soviet Union, and the Ku Klux Klan combined managed to do in over 75 years.
Well, and you know what's remarkable? I was listening to CBS Radio, and I don't think people pay attention. They made an interesting statement that a number of years ago, 61% of Americans were considered to be in the middle class. We are now down to 51%. And the statistic they used is kind of remarkable. They said that the bottom rung of the middle class was someone who earned in the mid-30s. I'd love to know how anybody can live on $35,000 or $40,000 a year and lay claim to being in the middle class. And they said the upper extreme of the middle class is $118,000 per year. Well, I understand $118,000, especially if you're not living in big cities and so forth. Yes, you could certainly live on that. But when you hear this nonsense that the middle class begins at $35,000 or even $40,000 a year, it's kind of like when they said the recession ended in 2009. I actually agree, it did. I think we went from a recession to a depression, but of course you're not going to hear that in mainstream media, are you?
Of course you are not. The mainstream media in this country and the entire vast academic community, so-called, in this country, all the vast structure of colleges around this nation, they have drugged themselves. The term conspiracy is meaningless when you go up against self-brainwashing and stupidity on a continental size scale. I covered the decline and fall of the Soviet Union. I got the first of my, in the 1980s, I got the first of my, actually the first two of my three Pulitzer Prize nominations for international reporting, covering the disintegration and collapse of the Soviet Union. In the period of Mikhail Gorbachev, the glasnost or openness era, there was far more openness and freedom of debate in the Soviet media, and there is far more openness and freedom of debate, incredibly, in the Russian media now. That is not to say I'm claiming that there is a democracy in Russia. I'm claiming no such thing. There is a quasi-autocracy in Russia under Putin, and yet there is still more room for disagreeing and critical points of view in the print media and online than there is across the entire vast United States of America, and that is inconceivable. You can say anything you like as long as it's on a marginalized website, but you can't even get on a crackpot radio show usually. You cannot say any alternatives to free trade. You cannot advocate border defense in the New York Times, in the Los Angeles Times, in any of the major newspapers of Washington, D.C., or Chicago, or anywhere else. You certainly cannot do it on Fox. You cannot do it in MSNBC or CNN. You cannot do it anywhere. Try.
Well, you know what's remarkable? You know, I have also. And
exactly.
I'll tell you one anecdote. When we had the problem, as we do again now with West Nile, we were worried about the avian flu, if you remember, a couple years ago. I was on MSNBC, and I wish I could remember the young lady who was moderating what was billed as a debate. It was about as much of a debate as tying one boxer's hands behind his back and telling the other boxer they could use the guy's chin as a speed bag. What wound up happening, and then Janet Napolitano came on, and they broke away, so I never got to finish anyway. But for the first time in my life, somebody turned off a microphone while I was on the air. And I started to say, because they said, you know, they started to talk about immigration. It was two-on-one, this young lady who came in from one of these anti-border security organizations. And let's call them what they are. It's not pro-immigrant. I am pro-immigrant. You are pro-immigrant. And the difference
exactly.
between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar. But this was at a time when there was great concern that we could all become seriously ill with an insidious virus. And I started to say to them, what you need to understand is that Ellis Island was a quarantine station. And the host went ballistic and said, are you about to tell me that this is an immigration argument? I said, well, if it isn't, why did you invite me on? And I suddenly realized that I was talking into a dead microphone. And the two of them took turns being very derisive about this idea that this was an immigration issue. And then they broke away from Napolitano, and I was told thank you very much. And I was furious. Now, here was what I would have said had my microphone not been shut off. I did not believe for a moment, as they tried to make the case, that we could prevent the entry of the virus into America by keeping out illegal aliens, because it was obvious that the birds were transmitting this disease. It wasn't human-to-human contact. We believe birds were transmitting it. And by the way, if it is human-to-human contact, then we should try our best to keep people out. When I was at Kennedy Airport, if somebody came in with an apparent disease and we had a child come in with 105 fever, I'm not sure if the child survived, I immediately called public health. They whisked this kid away into quarantine at some hospital. And I got a very nice letter thanking me for doing my job. And I was an immigration inspector at the time. But here was the other point that they didn't give me the opportunity to say. Tamiflu and other antivirus drugs were in short supply. And the way that we do business, unlike other countries, is that if an illegal alien walks into an emergency room, that illegal alien is as entitled to medical care as you or I. In fact, perhaps more entitled, because they're going to ask me or you for our medical insurance card. If it's an illegal alien, they won't, because under EMTALA, they are compelled to treat anybody who walks through the doors, basically. So my concern was that we would have illegals charging the border because they couldn't get treatment in their home country of Mexico, seeking treatment here, and then they would get the lion's share of these antiviral drugs that were already in short supply, leaving Americans with nothing. And so I don't think there's anything inappropriate about talking about why border security is a part of the public health equation. In fact, it's in the law. The first ground for excluding an illegal alien from the United States, or excluding an alien from the United States, is if the alien has a dangerous communicable disease. But you see, reason, logic, and facts have nothing to do with the debate. And as a journalist, and I know you're a journalist, you're Oxford educated with 2 degrees, as I recall, in history and economics, agents and law enforcement and journalists are very similar. We're fact finders, as Jack Webb used
to
say on Dragnet, not just the facts. But the facts are no longer relevant.
Yes.
I mean, tell me where there's any fault in what it was I was trying to say on that program, Arnie.
Well, there would be no fault if you lived in an Aristotelian nation, in a nation where fact-finding was based on actually looking to find facts. But you don't live in such a nation, my friend. You live in a Platonic nation, in a nation that follows the model of Plato instead. Now, Plato was a totalitarian philosopher. He worshipped the concept of the absolute idea. And unlike Aristotle, he was not pragmatically driven. Aristotle was a philosopher and pioneer scientific theoretician who believed you had to look at factual evidence to construct your theories. Now, most of the scientific theories he came up with were absurd. He didn't know any better. But we use his methodology. If he had access to modern methodology, he would have done a much better job, and he would have scrapped a lot of his ideas. But Plato believed that the idea was perfect, that you had to have pure ideas that you reached, and then the facts were basically harnessed and crowded into place to fit into the existing paradigms. And if the facts didn't fit into your presupposition, well, so much the worse for the facts. And that's where you are. You are standing up for the physical defense of the borders of the United States of America in a society which has mentally already committed suicide, which for all its vast expenditures on weaponry and intelligence every year, it's all basically just to feed the bureaucracy and to feed whatever entities on Wall Street are functioning, were mainly getting their profits these days from outside the United States of America. You have a system which has gone berserk and no longer even pretends behind its rhetoric to protect the economic interests and the physical survival of the American people. And any facts that do not fit into the paradigms that it believes that pays lip service to are simply regarded as damned facts. They are not permitted to exist or to be acknowledged. And this is the world you live in.
I guess we should hang a slogan on our ports of entry that says, don't confuse us with the facts.
Oh, yeah. Actually, hang that out on in every edition of the New York Times and the Washington Post and Time and Newsweek, which have become jokes and pale echoes of what they at least aspire to be or pretended to be. And hang it out in every university lecture room in America. Nobody is taught to think in America. In American universities, everyone is simply taught to swallow the theories. Now, obviously, with medicine and science, there's a vast amount of technical knowledge you have to learn through the process, and you have to have later degrees for, just in order to make a complex technical society work. Absolutely. But all that evidence was based on scientific methods, was acquired by scientific methods. When it comes to economics, politics, sociology, true scientific methods has actually gone out of the window. Nobody looks at the track record. Look, in every economic department in this country, the principles of absolute free trade are theoretically taught and no alternatives or critiques of them are taught. But it's like arguing for a flat earth in the before Columbus in the medieval world. Because all the evidence was still there to prove that the world was round, that the world was a globe hanging in space. But if you ignore that evidence, you could believe the fantasy of a flat earth, or that even if the earth was a globe, the sun revolved around the earth, rather than the earth revolving around the sun. And it's the same with free trade. If you look at the actual record, the historical record of every modern society that goes back at least 800 years to the rise of the city-states of Renaissance Italy, before the Renaissance, when they become prosperous in the 12th and 13th centuries, you find in every case, in every society, all the way up to modern America, to modern China, modern Japan, modern Germany, the rise and fall of the British Empire, every society that practiced minimum government and respected property within its own borders, but also protected its own economy from unfair foreign competition, prospered. And every society that did not maintain economic defenses or was unable to maintain economic defenses, like China in the 19th century, became impoverished when imports went out of control. There has to be protection of economic borders for major nations and for major groups of nations, just as there has to be control over physical borders. And without those two things, your entire society will first of all decline rapidly into destitution and chaos and the breakdown of law and order, and eventually they will dissolve as the Roman Empire did. There was no control over immigration in the Roman Empire, and the Romans wouldn't pay the money to maintain a large enough trained army for border defenses. They believed in a small elite army. Is this starting to sound familiar? Which
yes,
was very good at what it did, but there is no alternative to having enough soldiers and policemen and border security guards guarding your threatened borders, whether that is at airports or seaports or land borders with Mexico or anyone else.
There's a couple of quick points I'll make, and I certainly agree with you, which is a nice thing, I guess. So I guess it's more interesting when we disagree, but it doesn't happen too often. There was an article today in the New York Times about how China, and by the way, the New York Times needs to change its motto from "all the news that's fit to print." I think a more appropriate slogan should be "you'll have a fit from what we print."
Well, I always thought that that slogan was unintentionally revealing. Anyway, you make a very good point. All the news that's fit to print. Who decides what's fit to print?
And but that really implies censorship, doesn't it?
Exactly. These guys are the guardians of Plato. They're Plato's guardians of his ideal republic. And Plato's ideal republic was actually the Soviet Union. It was communism. It was a state where nobody held private property. Everybody was educated by the state. The state openly acknowledged teaching people lies, as Plato defined myth approvingly, that people would swallow so they would become good citizens. If you committed crimes, you weren't just put in jail. You went into work camps. You become slaves of the state, just as they did in the Soviet Union.
And China.
Yes. If you read Karl Marx, Das Kapital, one of the most destructive books alongside Hitler's Mein Kampf that's ever been written, that inspired communist revolution that led to probably at least 100 million deaths in the 20th century, if not more. Even Marx is naive. Marx nowhere says in the two vast volumes of Das Kapital, or is it three? You know, one would have been too many. But nowhere does he advocate controlled borders. Nowhere does he advocate propaganda, lying to the people in the state. And nowhere does he advocate gulags or prison camps.
So how does that
which
spring
are absolutely
up?
Necessary. And yet all of this is in Plato. All of this is in Plato.
Well,
and the philosophy of Plato is also one motive. I mean, obviously, I don't want to stretch the analogy too far. The New York Times is not communist, never has been. But it is Platonic. The people who run the New York Times really believe their motto, and that means that they are free to suppress or ignore any facts or trends or evidence or data that they simply want to ignore. And they
Their idea of compromise is, I'll do it my way and you'll do it my way. But let me just get to the point I was making about China. Well, they suddenly said that they're now deceiving their own people, because guess what's happening in China as America's middle class crumbles? They have warehouses filled to the rafters with junk they can't sell. See, Americans are the greatest consumers in the world. And I thought it was remarkable that after 9/11, we were told to go to the mall, spend money. I'm sure, maybe I shouldn't say I'm sure, but I wonder if you saw the Michael Douglas sequel to Wall Street, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps.
Not yet. No, go on.
You need to see it, because 30 minutes into the film, he goes before, I think it's at Fordham University, but I could be mistaken, and he does this five-minute speech where supposedly he's hawking this book that he's written about his experiences. His name is Geico, if you remember. He goes to jail for insider trading and all this other business. And he said, you know, a long time ago I said that greed was good. Now it seems as though it's legal. And he talks about how the major corporations don't make money by manufacturing anything for anybody. It's all about their financial services. You know, I find it remarkable that banks refer to their so-called services as a product. And I've always said to people that I thought that if you were going to manufacture a product, you needed an assembly line with wood and nails and plastic and screws and wires and so forth, and that three-card Monty did not constitute a product. And basically, Gecko takes them to task. But what's remarkable is that China is now experiencing this problem because, you know, look, in America, they were able to successfully sell and market not only the Pet Rock, but the training manual for the Pet Rock. What other group of consumers would be as stupid as the average American consumer who could actually be sold a rock in a box? I mean, you can't make this stuff up. So my theory is that as the globalists watch everything collapsing around their ears, because I think it's inevitable, someone's going to wake up and say we need to nurture the middle class. You know, that was what immigration did. Immigration used to be the bailiwick of the Labor Department.
Look,
because they,
what you have just said is an optimistic and rational answer. And I just wrote my most recent book predicated on That Still Should Be Us, based on precisely your assumption that there were enough rational, decent, honest, patriotic people out there who would read my book as well as listen to you, and who would be at least interested enough to want to read and learn that the theories of out-of-control free trade, and in terms of, I mean, I work for a magazine called The Globalist. They know what I wrote. They're perfectly happy with it. Their concept of globalization is a benign globalization,
right.
And they look at areas like the European Union and countries in the European Union and Mercosur, the trade association in South America, which have raised the standards of living of their peoples. And they, like I, do not look at China as something to be demonized, but as a country which, with all its vast problems, has a leadership that has raised the standard of living in China. And they have done that by taking, they copied, I document this in my book, China in the past 30 years has copied the policies that made America great from 1860 to 1960. They are raising up their economy exactly the way we built the industrial economy of America 100 years ago. Now, America 100 years ago was no Garden of Eden. It was not. The average life expectancy for men was 41, or 44, I think, perhaps even less, and for women, 41 or even less. We've come a long way since then, thank God, both through medicine, but also because wealth was shared around far more freely. Decades through Republican and Democratic presidents, we closed the gap between the two rich and too poor. In the last 30 years, that gap has opened up vastly widely again. And look at the choice we have in this presidential election. The choice is between a president whose economic policies are a proved fiasco. He doesn't have a clue. The people around him don't have a clue. We're heading towards national bankruptcy within 4 years if we reelect the president. And he still may be a better choice than his, the only other choice we're given to him, Governor Romney, who boasts and glories in firing thousands of people and outsourcing jobs to China. No conception whatsoever of how to build an industrial economy. No.
All right, Martin, but here's the point. I also think, out of fairness to Mitt Romney, that he was misquoted about the fact that he liked to fire people.
I
have to be honest. I see Mitt Romney as a far superior choice.
But I really do not anymore. And look how hapless he was. I mean, on foreign policy, he's far worse than the president. He could blunder us into a world war without looking to it. And I do not say this lightly. His visit to Britain was an extraordinary fiasco. Britain is run by a conservative government. London is run by a conservative mayor. And Romney bungled the few words he had to speak there so pathetically badly that he led the prime minister of Britain, a great friend of this country, and the mayor of London, another great friend of this country, to have to cut him down to size and humiliate him. I mean, only an idiot does that. Or revealingly, a man who thinks he knows everything and actually knows nothing and is incapable of learning anything new.
But let me tell you what...
This is a very dangerous man.
I understand, but let me tell you my theory on this. Whether you like Mitt Romney or not, you look at a president of the United States who basically has invited terrorists to embed themselves in our country, who doesn't understand the dangers we face from Iran. Let me just give you a quick statement, by the way, and this I think is important. This is Alan Greenspan, who was the architect of the economic meltdown, who was invited by Chuck Schumer to be before the Senate Immigration Subcommittee on April the 30th, 2009. And he was talking about the need for more visas for high-tech workers around the world, right? And he said that our skills shortage, I trust, will ultimately be resolved through a reform of our primary secondary educational systems, but at best, that will take many years. An accelerated influx of highly skilled immigrants would bridge that gap and, moreover, carry with it two significant bonuses. Now catch this. No American is going to want to go to college when you drive down the wages. I mean, that's just the way it works. That's what capitalism and free enterprise is about. But he says, First, skilled workers and their families formed new households. They will, of necessity, moved into the vacant housing units. Well, how do those housing units become vacated? Because Americans went bankrupt, and this is before the meltdown.
Yes. Oh, yes,
and
exactly.
Then he said the current glut of which is depressing price of American homes, and of course house prices. House price declines are a major factor in mortgage foreclosures and the plunge in value of a vast quantity of U.S. mortgage-backed securities that has contributed substantially to the disabling of our banking system. Now, catch this, though. The second bonus would address the increasing concentration of income in this country. Greatly expanding our quotas for the highly skilled would lower wage premiums of skilled over lesser skilled. What artful language. Skill shortages in America exists because we are shielding our skilled labor force from world competition. Quotas have been substituted for the wage pricing mechanism. In the process, we have created, now catch this term, folks, a privileged elite whose incomes are being supported at non-competitively high levels by immigration quotas on skilled professionals. Eliminating such restrictions would reduce at least some of our income inequality. What is he saying? Bring in more foreign workers and we could take care of that privileged elite that you or I, Martin, would call the middle class. When I could hear a statement like that uttered by Greenspan, who was the architect of the meltdown, who stood behind this idea of providing subprime mortgages to illegal aliens, and you know what they're not even talking about, and I want you folks out there to think about this. In 2003, a gentleman by the name of Stephen McGraw testified before the House Immigration Subcommittee. At the time, John Hostetler was the chairman of the subcommittee. John was a good guy. Unfortunately, he lost his bid for re-election. I testified for him at a number of hearings before the Immigration Subcommittee. And what Stephen McGraw said, and at the time, McGraw was the head of intelligence for the FBI. This was not a lightweight. This was not some reporter for the New York Times. This is the head of intelligence for the FBI who said that the acceptance of Mexican matricular cards constituted a serious threat to national security because there was no way of verifying who these people were. So what we also know about the mortgage meltdown, no one talks about the credit cards. I wonder how many billions or tens or hundreds of billions of dollars in credit card debt were attributable to aliens who intentionally acquired multiple false identities using matricular cards and then did not repay the credit card bill.
Look,
you know, if I default on my mortgage, at least the bank keeps my land, the land my house is built on and the house that's built on the land. If you don't pay your credit card bill, they have, as we say in Yiddish, bupkis. They got nothing to hold on to. So they're standing there with paper and no money, and if you multiply that by hundreds of times per bad guy who could have easily gotten a matricular card even without being a citizen of Mexico, and then if you look at the Iranians who increasing numbers are being stationed in Venezuela, Iranian shock troops, these are the guys they call upon to pull off assassinations and plant bombs. These are the terrorists. They're now in increasing numbers in Venezuela, and you have Secretary of Homeland Security Napolitano with a straight face saying that, well, you know, from time to time terrorists cross the border, but the borders are secure. From time to time? That's like saying that in the middle of a firefight, it's perfectly safe while both sides are reloading. I mean, this is insanity. So I'll be honest with you, and I don't want to, you know, get too much into this, but I can't imagine another 4 years of this administration with these suicidal economic policies and suicidal immigration and border policies.
Well, I don't think the economic policies might change a little under Romney, but industry will not be created under Romney. Industrial borders will not be protected. American enterprises will not be protected under Romney. They simply will not. I make that prediction now, and if any or all of us are here 4 years from now, if Romney gets in, I'm ready to stand by this. We're up against Tweedledum and Tweedledee, or as Huey Long, who was a demagogue, but a very smart demagogue, the governor of and senator from Louisiana in the Great Depression 80 years ago. We have high populorum from the Republicans, and we have low popularum from the Democrats, or maybe it's the other way around. But these are two patent medicines. There's no change between them. Bernanke was not appointed by a Democratic president. He was appointed by a Republican president.
I understand
the record
that.
Of job loss under President George W. Bush was utterly criminal and incompetent. No serious attention was paid to border security for for purely electoral reasons, Bush puts 10,000 troops or extra border guards on the border, as you know, in the last year or two of his presidency.
But they weren't
which was a
armed,
the
and
ocean.
When they backed up in the sight of armed Mexican drug traffickers,
precisely.
They retreated and they got medals
precisely.
For retreating. I mean, this
precisely.
Was like something out of a bad Woody Allen movie, that the Army retreated, the National Guard retreated,
precisely.
And they were given
awards
for retreating fast enough.
And all the elite are really superb armed forces were thrown into missions impossible, which were a total waste of time, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I am struck, you should have one or two of these people on your show, bring on board veterans who have served recently in Afghanistan or Iraq, especially in Afghanistan. I am struck by the number of people I know who went there straight arrows, highly democratic, believing in the mission, and who came back not just starred on the mission, but starred on our whole political system of government. And it isn't, they're rightly not blaming it on President Obama personally. Many of them went there under President George W. Bush. They just see the whole system as irredeemably broken.
Well, you know what's remarkable? You and I know each other, and here's an interesting story, folks. Martin and I met because we both are speakers for an organization that I'm very proud to be a part of. It's Allen L. Fried Associates. They conduct seminars for the various government agencies, the intelligence services, and the military. And I saw Martin do a presentation, and I believe we were in Dayton, Ohio at the time, outside Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And you lit up the stage, the front of the room. I have to tell you, it was an impressive performance that you did, for lack of a better term, I guess. But, you know, one of the questions I love to ask military officers when I'm standing in front of a bunch of colonels and generals and so forth is to ask them, why on earth do we still have a military? And, of course, you need to duck after you say that because that's not what they want to hear. And then I have to clarify my statement. And I've said to them, is it not accurate to say that the primary mission of our military is to keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible? And, of course, every head in the audience bobs in unison. And then I say to them, well, how on earth can you accomplish your primary objective when our borders only exist on maps, when we already have millions, if not tens of millions, of foreign nationals from the four corners of the planet living in nearly every city and town across this vast nation, where there is no record of their entry, there is no way of knowing their true names or their countries of citizenship, there is no way, therefore, of knowing their backgrounds or their affiliations, and certainly no way of knowing their intentions. So I ask them, how on earth can you protect us from the next terrorist attack? With all of those valiant, courageous, dedicated, motivated soldiers under your command, and all of the weaponry, the nuclear submarines, the nuclear aircraft carriers, and stealth bombers, what on earth will you do if, God forbid, there's a mushroom cloud over a major city tomorrow?
I have to be going off now.
Yes.
Again, my thanks for you for having me on. It's always a pleasure and a privilege.
Before you go, I just want to know one thing. What did you think of my statement to those military folks?
It was a classic example of they must have hated it because they were asked to indulge in what Edward de Bono called lateral thinking.
No,
you
you're wrong. They
across,
came up to me. They came up and said that they couldn't agree with me more. And they were furious over it, by the way.
Well, in that case, you've broken through a major breakthrough because the most difficult thing in this country is to get people to entertain a new idea or an old idea that's been forgotten but is legitimate. The saving of the United States has to start with people asking the right questions and refusing to accept the wrong answers or the meaningless answers.
Well, you know, I'll just
again,
say this.
Thank you.
All right, Martin, I will let you go. I thank you so much for joining me. And, you know, you did a great job on that video at talkborder.com. I hope you like it when you go check it out. You know, folks, it was a pleasure having Martin on the show with me today. And what he just said about asking the right questions is correct. I want to give you a little bit of food for thought before we head off for our weekend celebrations, wherever they may be. But here's the point. I always love to ask people, what is it that is the best return, the greatest return that we get on all the money that we spend on the space program? And what we get in exchange for the Voyager spacecraft that are now hurtling out of the solar system, for Curiosity on Mars, for all these amazing spacecraft, is the next series of questions. And that's what we're not really taught to do any longer as a country. We're not taught to question, and we're not taught to figure out what the next series of questions must be. Because that gives you a sense of where we're headed, whether we're going the wrong way on a one-way street. And I believe that we are, but I respectfully disagree with Martin about his assessment of who the best candidate is for the presidency. I see a choice this year. Not the best choice, perhaps, but I do see a choice. But what I want all of you to understand is that that dichotomy in opinion is what America is supposed to be about. We have a First Amendment that talks about the right to peaceably assemble. Well, why on earth do you think the Founding Fathers were so focused on the right to peaceably assembling? Because they understood that freedom of speech is worthless unless we are able to sit down with one another or stand across from one another and have that disagreement, the argument, the debate, the discussion, the discourse, to try to reach some kind of a reasonable conclusion, to try to pull things together at the end, maybe through a little bit of compromise and a willingness to listen to somebody whose opinion may not, at least initially, coincide with our own, so we can teach each other and learn in the process ourselves. That's what's so brilliant about the Constitution, about the Bill of Rights, but especially the First Amendment. And that's why I do this program here at the Michael Cutler Hour. That's why I also do TalkBorder.com. That's why I write for The Social Contract. I have another article that will be in their fall edition. There is now an article in their summer edition about who profits from illegal immigration. In fact, I entitled my article, Immigration, the Modern Day Gold Rush. In the fall edition, I've turned my attention on the victims of illegal alien, turned my attention to the victims of illegal immigration. And I think you may find some surprises in what I had to say. But basically, fundamentally, our immigration laws are among the most fundamental and important laws that not only America, but that any country can possibly enact. The enforcement of border security and the enforcement of immigration laws are supposed to be an integral component of national security. That's the bottom line. If you know that there are bad guys in your neighborhood, the police will give you advice as to how to secure your doors and your windows and your skylight and perhaps install a burglar alarm to make certain that no one gains access to your premises who would do harm to you. There are plenty of people around the world who would love nothing better than to do harm to America. If we don't keep them out, if we let them in, if we provide them with an opportunity to embed themselves in our country in the parlance of the 9/11 Commission, or as I like to say, hide in plain sight, then we are creating a huge national security nightmare for this country. And it's the old saying of once you get the toothpaste out of the tube, there's no putting it back. It's not about vilifying immigrants. You know, the immigration laws are completely and utterly blind as to race, religion, or ethnicity. The only distinction the immigration laws make is between what it is to be a citizen and what it is to be, there's that word, alien. And the term alien is not a nasty word. It's not the N-word. It doesn't denigrate or insult anybody. It's not a pejorative. Under our laws, the term alien simply means any person who is not a citizen or national of the United States. And virtually every other country on the planet has a comparable term that they use. Mexico, in fact, the country that sends us more illegal aliens than any other country, primarily a function of geography. It's the only place where the First World and the Third World collide, and those two countries collide along the Mexican-U.S. border. They use the term extranjero, which can be translated in one of two ways, alien or foreigner. So it's not that this is a bad word, it's just that it is a word that provides clarity to a debate where those who oppose border security understand that they cannot win the debate if they have to base it purely on facts, law, common sense, and morality. Those are all opposed to their position. So the only tactic that is left to them is to use deceitful language and make nasty and false allegations so that we get that emotional issue going. And by the way, while we're on the topic of false statements, we hear so much about the only way that politicians can garner the Latino vote, and we're told that the president needs to vote for the DREAM Act or comprehensive reform and all this other business. There's no reason why any lawful immigrant, Hispanic or otherwise, Latino or otherwise, would want to see our immigration laws ignored. The unemployment rate is at an unacceptable level for all Americans, and it is even worse among the American, Latino, and black communities. By not enforcing our immigration laws and now by providing millions of illegal aliens with employment authorization, American workers will find it that much more difficult to succeed in getting a job that enables them to support themselves and their families. This will also enable aliens who are involved with criminal activity, just like the Mexican cartels that I noted in that CBS report by Pelley at the beginning of this program, will just provide more opportunities for those individuals to come to this country, set up shop, and continue their wave of violence as they struggle for turf. This is not in anybody's best interests. Certainly, the most damage is being done within the ethnic immigrant communities. That's where the damage is the greatest, and that's why I don't agree with that assessment. Anybody who's capable of rational thought understands that those immigration laws and those borders are supposed to protect all of us, and most particularly the members of the ethnic immigrant communities. Not rocket science, folks. That's just common sense. But, of course, seems that these days common sense is anything but common, doesn't it? In any event, I want to thank all of you for having joined me this Friday, August the 24th. Hope you all have a terrific weekend coming up, last weekend of August, as autumn is rapidly approaching. Have a terrific weekend, everybody. Please remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. I hope you will join me again next week at the same time at this program. But meanwhile, check out capsweb.org, talkborder.com, michaelcutler.net. Have a great weekend, everybody. So long for now.